Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Elliot Mintzberg of People for the American Way, who explains why his group is campaigning to defeat President Trump's nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court. Carol Burris of the Network for Public Education, who talks about why so many groups oppose the nomination of Betsy DeVos to be the next education secretary, and how the fight will continue now that she's been confirmed by the U.S. Senate. And former inmate Keyshard Tucker, who talks about the effects of spending time in solitary confinement, and the Inside the Box Project, whose goal is to inspire people to work toward ending solitary confinement in U.S. prisons. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte suspended the Southeast Asia nation's bloody war on drugs amidst reports of massive corruption in police drug units and after 7,000 people have been killed in his campaign against drug dealers. National Police Chief Ronald De La Rosa closed down anti-drug units after it was revealed that police had murdered South Korean businessman Ji Ik-ju, who was arrested by police and then strangled to death. Yet, after he was killed, police had still attempted to extort money from the victim's family. According to the BBC, 4,000 of the drug-related deaths were carried out by hit squads, which, critics believe, are organized and directed by the police. Investigations by human rights groups, Reuters and The Guardian newspaper reveal that these hit squads regularly carry out summary executions. Amnesty International, in a recent report, accused the Philippines police drug squads of operating like criminal gangs, taking cash payments for murders. Only days after suspending all police drug units, President Duterte mobilized the armed forces of the Philippines to be the new enforcers in his drug war. However, Human Rights Watch dismissed the move, since the military has a long history of committing summary executions and abuses against anti-government insurgents and other opposition groups. According to the Center for Public Integrity, the Pentagon has trained at least 17 high-ranking foreign military officers at some of its top academies, who later committed criminal offenses and human rights abuses in their home countries. Buried in annual State Department reports to Congress on the International Military Education and Training, or IMET, program, U.S.-trained foreign officers were implicated in serious rights abuses, including extrajudicial killings in Colombia, torture inflicted on Maoist rebels in Nepal, and murder during civil conflict in Bolivia. Human rights monitors say the number of U.S.-trained foreign officers involved in abuses is much higher than the figures revealed in State Department reports. A separate report by the independent Center for International Policy identified 33 foreign military officers who later committed crimes or abuses after receiving U.S. military or police training. The state of Maine in recent years has been hit by a sagging economy and has seen growing disruption of the environment in its oceans and forests due to climate change. At the same time, climate change could open up new trade opportunities with Arctic nations like Iceland and Greenland as melting ice frees up ocean shipping lanes. Government officials and indigenous leaders met last fall in Maine to plot new strategies for sustainable development and protection of the ecosystems across northern nations. In 2013, an Icelandic shipping company, Eimskip, set up its U.S. operations in Maine. Now, three ships arrive in Portland each month, linking downeast Maine with cities like Rotterdam in the Netherlands, Reykjavik in Iceland, and Tromsø in Norway, with shipments of frozen fish and dry goods. Yet Maine scientists are looking with great concern at the rapid warming of the Arctic and regional environment. Over the last decade, water temperatures in the Gulf of Maine have risen twice as fast as in other oceans, leading, for example, to the collapse of cod fisheries with dire economic consequences for local fishermen. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees. Thank you.
After the death of the Supreme Court's staunchest conservative and longest-serving justice, Antonin Scalia, on February 13th last year, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell asserted that the nomination of a replacement should wait until after the November 2016 presidential election. In March, President Obama, following the U.S. Constitution, nominated Merrick Garland, Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, to fill the vacancy. As promised, the GOP-controlled Senate blocked a hearing or vote on Garland's nomination, resulting in a Supreme Court short one justice, leading to several 4-4 ties between the conservative and liberal wings of the court on key cases. After President Trump's surprise November election victory, he followed through on his campaign pledge to nominate an individual to the Supreme Court that would be as conservative as Justice Scalia, whom he would replace. On January 31st, the real estate billionaire announced his nominee, Neil Gorsuch, a federal appeals judge in Denver, who was well known nationally for taking the side of religious organizations that opposed parts of the Affordable Care Act that compelled insurance coverage for contraceptives. In one related case, Burwell v. Hobby Lobby Stores, later decided by the Supreme Court, Judge Gorsuch wrote of the need for U.S. courts to give broad latitude to religious beliefs. To his many progressive opponents, Judge Gorsuch's record indicates that he would be a strong ally of wealthy corporations, challenging laws that protect workers, consumers, and the environment. Your reporter spoke with Elliot Mintzberg, a senior fellow with People for the American Way, who explains why his group is campaigning to defeat President Trump's nomination of Judge Gorsuch to the high court.
President Trump said he wanted somebody who would be as far to the right as Scalia, and frankly, he's done even better than that. He has found somebody who, in some respects, is to the right of Justice Scalia. Judge Gorsuch has a consistent record throughout his judicial career and even his pre-judicial career as a lawyer of strongly favoring corporations at the expense of workers and other ordinary citizens. One of my favorite unfortunate examples of that was a case involving a corporation that had failed to train a worker. And the company had acknowledged that it needed to train workers on this, but this guy started working after the training had happened. Unfortunately, what the training was about was how to avoid problems with high-voltage electrical wires. As a result, this poor worker got electrocuted. Well, the Department of Labor decided that, you know, there ought to be a fine for this kind of negligent behavior. And in fact, Judge Gorsuch's 10th Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with that, but Gorsuch dissented and wanted to go for the corporation, not for the individual worker. That's just one of a number of cases like that that is throughout Judge Gorsuch's career. He goes further than Justice Scalia because he wants to overturn the so-called Chevron doctrine, under which agencies like the Department of Labor, when they make regulations that protect health, safety, etc., generally get deference unless their regulations are unreasonable. Gorsuch wants to eliminate that doctrine completely, for example. But at the same time, he's particularly dangerous now because of what we've seen recently from President Trump, the immigration order in particular, which is now being contested. We need judges and justices who will stand up against that kind of action. Right now, the Supreme Court is split 4-4. One justice going the wrong way could easily see that and many other future orders by President Trump upheld. And again, Judge Gorsuch's record is troubling. For example, in one case, again, the majority of the Tenth Circuit agreed to stop the governor of Utah from unilaterally defunding Planned Parenthood. Judge Gorsuch dissented and said, essentially, we should defer to the governor. We don't need a justice who will essentially defer to the president on those kinds of critical issues. Those are just a few examples, but they give you and your listeners an idea of what is so troubling about Judge Gorsuch.
Elliot, maybe you can speak to what strategies are being discussed among Senate Democrats to oppose this nomination, which most Senate Democrats have put on the record. But, of course, they have a minority in the Senate.
And the filibuster rule, as has been discussed by Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, could be done away with in the so-called nuclear option. What is it that you're hearing the Democratic strategy is here in confronting the nomination of Neil Gorsuch?
Well, I think the Democrats so far have done a very good job. There have been, as you've already said, a number of expressions of either serious concern or outright opposition by Democratic senators. And Senate Minority Schumer has framed the issue in a very good way. He hasn't talked about, quote-unquote, filibuster. What he said is, look, particularly at this time in our history, and given what's gone on in the past, any nominee to the Supreme Court should achieve some consensus and should be able to get 60 votes. After all, that was the standard that effectively all four of the last Democratic nominees were held to, both the nominees of President Clinton and the two who got votes by President Obama, Sotomayor and Kagan, all got more than 60 votes. So why shouldn't that apply to Gorsuch as well? Now, what happens if the Democrats stand fast? They demand that, and the Republicans say, no, we want to do it by 51 votes, which we can do if we can get every Republican, and we might trigger the nuclear option. Well, two things. First of all, we're hopeful that as more and more senators look at this, we might be able to get a few Republican votes. There have been a few Republican votes, as you know, already against cabinet nominee DeVos, and we're hopeful that we could get a few and maybe a few more with respect to the Supreme Court, which is, after all, a lifetime appointment, not just for President Trump's administration. But second, what we're also hearing, even this early, is that even among senators who are likely to support Judge Gorsuch, they are very reluctant to trigger this nuclear option to eliminate the possibility of a filibuster of a Supreme Court nominee, because when a Democrat's in the White House, they want to see that threshold met as well. So we're very hopeful that even if they will not oppose Gorsuch, we will see all we need is three Republican senators, because they do need 51 to trigger it, who will be unwilling to trigger the nuclear option. And frankly, if they do trigger it, the American people need to see that and see just what's happened and how dangerous the Republicans in the Senate are.
That was Elliot Mintzberg, a senior fellow with the group People for the American Way. Find more analysis of Judge Gorsuch's judicial record by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Among President Trump's many controversial nominations to his cabinet, his pick of Betsy DeVos to become Education Secretary drew some of the most passionate and widespread opposition. DeVos, a billionaire philanthropist, charter schools advocate, and one of the nation's largest contributors to Republican Party candidates, came under withering criticism for her efforts in her home state of Michigan and across the country to dismantle and privatize public education. A longtime supporter of for-profit public charter schools and giving taxpayer-funded vouchers to parents who send their children to private schools, DeVos personally never attended or sent her children to public schools. But despite a nationwide grassroots campaign that made hundreds of thousands of calls to legislators and organized protests, the U.S. Senate narrowly confirmed DeVos in a February 7th vote that required Vice President Mike Pence to cast a deciding vote to break a 50-50 tie, a first in votes for a cabinet nominee. Your reporter spoke with Carol Burris, executive director of the Network for Public Education, who explains why so many educators, teachers unions, and parents groups oppose the DeVos nomination, and how her group intends to continue to fight her agenda of school privatization as it moves forward.
She's unqualified. She's never taught. She's never attended a public school. The only involvement that she says she's had in a public school was that she mentored in a public school, whatever that means. She's never been involved in policy decisions regarding public schooling. Betsy has no qualifications. The second reason is that it really smacks of a political appointment. Her family has given millions upon millions of dollars to the Republican Party, and she's been very outright in stating that she believes that giving them money should buy her influence. She makes no bones about it. So, you know, this feeling as though, you know, she's getting this because of what she's given in the past. But at least for our organization, probably the greatest reason why we oppose her is that she has made it very, very clear that her agenda is to privatize schools in America, that she believes in a free market, and that she believes that if people are allowed to, and groups are allowed to open up schools, that will open and close depending upon whether parents are interested in them. If people are allowed to make a profit by educating students, if taxpayer money can go to a variety of private schools, including those that are religious schools, that somehow the marketplace will work its magic and kids will receive a better education. Well, you know, that's been tried in a couple of places. It's been tried in Chile. It's been tried in Sweden. It's been proven not to work. And the end result is the destruction of the national public school systems in those countries. She's made no bones about it. We know of no attempts that she's ever made to work within the public school system to make public schools better. We know of no donations that she's ever made to public schools. We only know that her work has focused on the destruction of public schools, which she has called a dead end and a monopoly.
If, as expected, the Senate confirms Betsy DeVos as the next Secretary of Education, what powers will she have to push forward her agenda of more charter schools, more for-profit schools, more religious schools getting public funds, and the general goal of moving our education system to privatization?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's an interesting question because a lot of us have been debating that. I mean, certainly she's going to need Congress's approval to work on some of these issues. I don't think she can unilaterally, for example, take all Title I funds, as Donald Trump said he'd like to do, and turn them into block grants. I believe, you know, my understanding is you'd have to have the Senate and the House of Representatives on board with those kinds of ideas. But, I mean, when you think about what Arne Duncan was able to accomplish with Race to the Top, and with regulations, changing some regulations, she can do a decent amount of damage. And then, of course, the worry is that the agenda in the House and in the Senate, where it's part of the Republican platform that they believe in choice. And when they mean choice, what they really mean is privatization. They change the name because choice sounds better. She's probably going to have some support in that. There was already a House bill that we saw that's been presented that would allow federal funds to go for vouchers. I mean, that has not been allowed so far, but there it is.
So you feel pretty confident that all the people who have mobilized thus far to oppose Betsy DeVos's nomination will stay active if and when she's confirmed?
Yeah, yeah, I do. Now, will some fall away? Yeah, I imagine they will. But we already have our email to those 316,000 people ready to go to tell them to keep heart and to share with them our pathway forward in fighting this. We are not going to sit back and say, hey, this is okay. Our hope, too, is that we will start to engage with more elected officials, both Democrat and Republican, and help them understand what's at stake and why some of the policies that they've been supporting around charter schools are really policies that are going to destroy a lot of the public schools.
That was Carol Burris, Executive Director of the Network for Public Education. Learn more about the groups that have vowed to continue their opposition to Betsy DeVos's agenda of privatizing public schools by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The concept of prison solitary confinement was originated 2 centuries ago to give incarcerated individuals a chance to reflect on their crimes and vow to follow the straight and narrow upon release. But now extended solitary confinement, more than 15 days, is considered torture under international law. At any given time in the U.S., it's estimated that more than 80,000 people are being held in solitary confinement, which means being isolated in a cell with no human contact for 23 hours a day. Of that number, many inmates have been held under those conditions for years and some for decades. From January 30th to February 18th, residents of New Haven, Connecticut will have a chance to experience solitary confinement by sitting in a replica of a solitary cell. The program, dubbed Inside the Box, is a project launched by a coalition led by the National Religious Coalition Against Torture. The replica cell will travel to 3 area libraries, and public programs of panels, films, and art exhibitions are being offered daily, with the goal of inspiring people to work toward ending solitary confinement in U.S. prisons. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Keyshar Tucker, now 35 years old, who served several stints in solitary confinement in Connecticut jails and prisons, the first when he was just 16. Here he describes what spending time in solitary is like and how he hopes the Inside the Box project will help end the practice.
What initially got me sent to solitary confinement was basically I couldn't cope with being in prison. I was in prison for a charge that I never was, I wasn't even convicted of. And I was having a hard time, and I was getting disciplinary reports, which they call tickets, for just acting out and not obeying, direct orders, which was they call it, from the correctional officers. And they gave me a few tickets, and it sent me to, I started in the county jail on Willie Avenue, and 3 tickets, back-to-back tickets, sent me into Manson Youth Solitary Confinement, which they call chronic. And in chronic, you're in a cell, and anytime you come out the cell, you're handcuffed. If you go to rec, you're handcuffed. If you you go to the shower, they handcuff you until you get into the shower, then they unhandcuff you. And what happened in the situation, which led me, which sent me to Northern Maximum Security Solitary Confinement. I went to the shower, and as I was getting out the shower, they put the handcuffs back on. The CO was, yanking my handcuffs, pulling me, dragging me towards the cell. And I yanked back, and I fell. And I think I fell on top of him, or he fell on top of me. I don't remember exactly which one. And he read the report up as if I assaulted him. And that got me sent to Northern, which is a level 5 maximum security prison where they house, at that time they was housing death row inmates. And I was 17 years old, and I was thinking, wow, this is the craziest, most horrific place I've ever been to. You're handcuffed and you're shackled, and they strip you down naked. And then after they strip you down, Nikki, they give you a uniform, the Northern uniform. And then they put the cuffs back on and they shackle you. And then you got to travel down this long hallway. I remember going down this hallway, I couldn't do it. The shackles was just hurting my legs, my skin. And I couldn't walk anymore. And they had to pick me up and carry me to the cell. It was just the worst place ever. So 4 months altogether, I was in solitary confinement.
So one thing I wondered, when you were in solitary, were you able to have books?
Sometimes I was able to get a book. Sometimes they would only give you religious books. And sometimes I didn't have books. Yeah, because I've been in solitary confinement several times. Sometimes you get lucky and you get a chance to get a book.
Are you a bad dude?
No, I'm not a bad dude. I'm not a bad dude. Like I said, I just couldn't cope with being in prison. I never had any violence. I'm not a violent person. Anytime I was in prison, it was for a nonviolent crime. And just me not being able to cope, sent me into solitary confinement.
They didn't offer any kind of counseling, or, I mean, the only response was basically to put you in solitary?
Yeah, that was the only response to anyone acting out or anyone who couldn't cope, whether it was because you had mental health issues or whatever the case may be. The response to that is punishment.
How old are you now?
35.
And do you still experience difficulties from the times you were in solitary?
Yeah, definitely. I'm getting better. The period of time I was on medication for my anxiety, I didn't feel comfortable being in open spaces around a lot of people. I would have anxiety attacks, panic attacks, and I had to learn how to cope.
So, Keyshire Tucker, did you go inside the box here at this, inside this replica of a solitary confinement cell?
Yeah, I went in a box area.
And how did that compare to being in a real box in prison?
I mean, it's a little bigger. It's a little bigger, just a little bit, from being in the box that I was in before. It reminded me of being in that place. But the thing with me was, I know that I can open the door and leave out any time that I wanted. So I didn't have to stand there that long. It was scary.
So do you think, for people who've never been in a jail cell, do you think that project is a good project to try to raise awareness and try to maybe get people involved and try to make changes?
Yeah, I think it's a good project. And I think that it does bring awareness. A lot of people have never seen inside of a cell before and can't really imagine or picture what would you be doing in solitary confinement, or what do you got to deal with, what are you thinking, what type of pain you're going through. Or it does definitely brings awareness.
That was Keyshire Tucker, a former inmate who spent time in solitary confinement in Connecticut prisons. For more information on the Inside the Box project and the movement to end solitary confinement in U.S. prisons, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.